Rings programs, and welcome to another episode of Quarks and Recreation. I'm your co-host, Doug.
I'm your other co-host, Brandon.
And with me today is my friend, Jordan Maxwell.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Jordan, we have on the show because we are doing Science of Superheroes, and I can't think of anybody who is more of a comic book expert than you, Jordan.
Well, I appreciate that. I've spent a long time becoming so.
You went to superhero college for a long time.
Yes, I got my master's. did not quite get my doctorate in strangeness or doom.
But in evil, at least, you have a master's.
Yes, I am a master of evil.
All right, great. Where do you want to start? Brandon, you got some topics you want to kick off or a character to go with? Anything?
Well, is it even possible to, like, do anything a superhero can do?
I guess I would start with Batman, right? I mean, he's the most obvious choice there because he has no powers to speak of except for richness.
Sure. I mean, you know, anyone in that camp of sort of the ultra-rich, kind of more pulpy hero, the Green Arrow or Iron Man, who, like, develops their own skills and technology. If you have enough money and enough time and whatever kind of rage or boredom is driving you to want to, you know, go out at night and beat up muggers.
A.K.A. dead parents.
Sure, yeah, dead parents are always a good classic. the old, I love the old pulp era of the, like, the 20s and 30s, where it was anyone's origin could basically just be, I'm a bored socialite and I want to go punch poor people who are robbing other poor people.
Right. But sure, I mean, you could do at least certain things that Batman does, or any of these guys. Like, for example, yeah, sure, anybody can learn martial arts. Anybody can pick up a grappling hook and learn to use it. I mean, maybe they can't build a car that can turn into a plane, but I guess you could.
If Richard Branson wanted to go and, like, chase down psychopaths and muggers and things like that, he could probably develop a car that would turn into a plane. He has developed a car that turns into a boat.
Actually, so. Yeah, in fact, there was a, I guess he's not technically a superhero in the comic book sense, but James Bond, and gosh, which one is it? The first one with Jaws, The Spy Who Loved Me, I think.
Yeah.
He's got a car that turns into a boat. And in fact, I think some rich guy, Mark Cuban, one of those guys, bought it. And it is actually trying to, like, make sure it functionally works. But it's the exact car from the movie.
Oh, wow.
Now, there's not a lot of underwater crime to stop, but...
Sure. That's you know, I leave that to the Aquamans and Namors of the world.
But, sure.
but, yeah, if you got, like, really good at archery, you could be, like, a Hawkeye or Green Arrow, but... you know, it's...
yeah, that's not even...
That would be as useful a skill in actual urban crime fighting as it often appears to be in those comics.
Sure, I mean, you don't encounter too many muggers who are also armed with arrows. They've got guns.
Right, yeah. So you've got to be really good, you know, also really good at maybe developing armor or... really lucky at dodging bullets.
Well, armor's a good one, actually. Like, there's substances like Kevlar that are used by real police, and that's what bulletproof vests are made out of. And it's a material that's really, really good. It's made out of a ceramic. And it's good at... It doesn't make the bullet not hurt. I mean, it gets... Any person who's been shot with a Kevlar vest will tell you it hurts, but it's not piercing through your rib cage and puncturing organs. So it's at least a start. Where else do you want to go from here, science-wise?
Is it possible to fly?
With a plane ticket.
Yeah.
No. They're developing jetpack technology now.
I mean...
But not under your own speed right now, no.
No one can run fast enough to make a pair of wings function like a jet airplane. I mean, people have been trying to do this for... a long, long time. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci famously tried to develop a human flying machine, which was basically a giant wooden pair of wings. The problem is human pectoral muscles just don't have the strength to flap something like that hard enough to generate the force, the upward force, to lift you. So the Earth's gravity is really strong. So think about it. If you weigh 100 pounds, that is 100 pounds of force down. You need at least 100 pounds of force up against gravity to really move you anywhere. So where are you going to generate it? Now, you can jump, But even then, if you jump, what do you get? A couple of feet, and then you're right back down again.
And physiologically, I mean, the creatures that can fly on our planet, birds, mm-hmm. Have their bones are more...
Well, they're hollow. Yeah.
Yeah. And so even... like a character like Angel from the X-Men, they actually have explained, like, part of his mutation is that his skeletal structure is more similar to that of birds than of humans, so he doesn't have as dense a bone structure to have to counteract those gravitational effects.
Right. In fact, even the earliest version of Superman couldn't fly in the comics. That's why they have that whole thing about able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. That's what he could do. He could jump really high. And eventually they added in the flying, which... I don't think they've ever really explained the flying, other than...
No, it's, you know, oh, his Kryptonian cells are so supercharged that blah, blah, blah.
Right. Science-y magic. For Superman. But sure, that human flight, I'm trying to think of... I mean, even a character like Iron Man, who has a suit that can fly, you still have the problem of, well, how do you store enough energy in the machine to be able to... You think about how many... you ever see a battery for a hybrid car? They're heavy. They're very, very heavy. And there's a lot of them just to move the car containing the human. So you might not need as much energy to move a 200-pound human as a 2,000-pound vehicle. But even still, the batteries have weight. So you need enough energy in the battery to lift the battery, let alone the person holding the battery.
So that's why, like, the big advancement that they talk about, especially in the movies, is not so much that he developed the armor, it's that miniaturized arc reactor that runs it. It's that he was able to, like, make such a small but powerful battery to run everything.
That he doesn't have that problem. Like, you know, if you felt like strapping a nuclear reactor to your a miniaturized nuclear reactor to your chest... go nuts. In fact, that even sort of
thought of doing that from time to time.
Right. I mean, and that's sort of the line, a plot line from Iron Man 2, is that he starts to actually get ill from having this thing lodged in his chest, full of what is it, palladium or some other some other chemical element like that that's just not really meant for human consumption. I think flight is possible, but like we said, not under your own steam. You need a machine to do it. So, what's your favorite comic book movie, Brandon? Like, what's one?
I think I like X-Men.
Okay.
And my favorite, I think, is probably the Batman and Spider-Man's.
Okay. Well, let's talk about maybe X-Men is a good place to start, because that's kind of science-y. That gets into genetics.
It's based in a scientific concept, at least.
At least something, yeah. That they're all genetic. Yeah. It comes from their DNA, right? They have this mutant X gene that manifests in different ways. So Wolverine can heal really fast, or Rogue can touch people and they die. You have to first understand a little bit about how genes work and how genetic mutations work. So genes, we've talked about this a little bit on the cast before, but genes are in a coded molecular language. So there's four molecules. DNA looks like a ladder, and there's four different molecules that make up the rungs of the ladder. So you've got cytosine, guanine, thymine, and adenine, I think. It's C-T-A-G. Yeah. And they pair off. So I believe C pairs with T and A pairs with G. I could be totally wrong about that, but they pair off one by one. So the way genes reproduce is you unzip the ladder. You've got half of these molecules on one side. Because they pair off one to one, you can figure out what the other molecules should be on the other side. So you just fill in all of the blanks. You basically paint by numbers, and then you've got your other part of the DNA molecule, and now you've replicated it. A mutation occurs when something in that process gets screwed up. And what the genes do is that each sequence of genes, like a set of those letters, correspond to an amino acid, a building molecule of your body. So when you screw up the sequence, you end up with a different molecule in the recipe than you were supposed to get, and that will cause changes in the ultimate person, or the being with the gene. So mutations can happen, but the problem is, if you want to make a mutation that causes, like, Angel, who has literal bird wings attached to his back, that's not just one letter off. That's like, so many mutations that it's like winning the lottery, 50 times over in a day. Like, it's an enormous number of complex things that have to change to get that result. Make sense?
And then the notion, oh, at least the prominent theories of evolution are that these changes that eventually kind of become standard for a species or that could be used in some advantageous way, you know, like a giraffe's really long neck or, you know, the I'm completely blanking on biology.
A cheetah speed or something. You know.
A cheetah speed, yeah, exactly. These kind of things that make it advantageous to survival happen gradually over the course of several generations, and those traits are passed down from parent to child. The kind of difference within terms of the X-Men and their evolution, I mean, the kind of comic booky, sciencey, whyncy kind of thing, is that this huge leap in evolution has happened all at once, and that these traits aren't so much species-wide as, like, they're specifically keyed into the individuals. And sometimes a child's mutation, you know, the child of two mutants in Marvel Comics would have potentially a wholly separate mutation from either parent or some combination, depending on what the writer wants, you know, their power to be.
Right. You start with the power first and work backwards.
Yeah, exactly. There was a character from a book called Exiles who was actually a really popular character for a while, and then the book got canceled and she kind of vanished, but her name was Nocturne, and she was from this alternate reality where Nightcrawler from the X-Men and Scarlet Witch, who just appeared in Age of Ultron, there's no spoiler there, she's in the trailers, but that they had gotten together in this other timeline, and Nocturne had been their daughter. So she is blue and furry and has the tail like Nightcrawler, and she can kind of teleport, but she's also got kind of her mom's hexing ability a little bit. So it's like something like she like had to teleport to activate the hexing, so she would like grab somebody, teleport them, and then when they landed, something would have happened to the person. Or it's been a long time since
they kind of put her in a blender with the two parents. And
yeah, it's like, yeah, here's how those two powers work together. But then, you know, something like someone like Cable, who's the child of Cyclops and a clone of Phoenix, Marvel Girl, Jean Grey, whatever you want to call her, doesn't have any, like, optic blasts, but he does have psychic ability. So it's, you know, I get, like, optic blasts would be, like, on a recessive gene in that right. Mendel's hair. And psychic powers are a very dominant gene, I guess. But yeah, it's an interesting thing because it's not that sort of species-wide trait being like, you know, propagated throughout. It's just kind of like, it's like, no, it's advantageous to be a mutant, and so you get a superpower of some kind.
Right, but they don't necessarily track along family lines or anything
like
that.
Yeah, not always. And it's not a case where, you know, it's like, oh, now everybody has wings because it's really, you know, because Angel has wings and that's really, it's good to be able to fly. No, sometimes characters have wings. Sometimes they have, like, characters have wings who are completely unrelated to another character has wings. It's, you know, a much more random mutation. They explain it through the presence of they call it this became much later continuity, but of the X gene in their genetic makeup,
which expresses in different ways. Basically,
yeah, exactly. So it's just like it is advantageous to have the X gene, but it's a complete crapshoot as to what you're actually going to get as your power.
And that actually kind of feeds into something in genetics called genotype versus phenotype. So genotype is what your underlying genetic makeup is, like in the blueprint. Your phenotype is what's expressed. So for example, you can have a dominant gene and a recessive gene in your genotype, but you're only going to see the dominant gene on the surface. So for example, brown eyes are a dominant gene. So you might have a gene for, if you're a brown-eyed person, blue eyes lurking in there that you could pass on to your children one day, but when we look at you, we'll never see it. We'll only see the brown eyes. Now, you have blue eyes, which are, Brandon, which are two recessive genes. But not all genes are quite that simple where it's just, hey, there's a dominant one, then there's a recessive one, and we do the genetic math, and boom. Genes tend to be a combination of lots of different parts of your DNA all working together in different ways. So some genes are that simple, but a lot of them are not. So for the X gene, you would need probably more than one X gene, and depending on what's in there, it would produce a different kind of X-Men. But again, all of it would need to be, or would develop over time because it was advantageous to have. It would help you just a little bit in terms of being able to reproduce. That's all you need for a gene to propagate. So, anything else you want to cover on the X-Men?
X-Men? Not as much X-Men, but Spider-Man.
Okay, what about Spider-Man?
Well, is it possible to get like bit by a spider and then be able to shoot webs out of your hand the next day?
Actually, Spider-Man can't even shoot webs out of his hands. Only in the Tobey Maguire ones, right?
Let's see. They developed for a while during the J. Michael Straczynski run on the book, that he evolved certain more abilities, and so he got the organic web shooters from the Maguire movies for a little while, and then they did this whole reboot.
What, a Spider-Man reboot? That's weird. who would think to do that?
Well, they just kind of, it was a weird, oh god, it was a whole, like, it wound up working out okay, but, like, the transition between the end of Straczynski's run and kind of the beginning of what they called at the time, the brand new day, and they pretty much just jettisoned almost everything. Like, this, if you talk to fans and they talk about the Peter Parker and Mary Jane Watson's marriage, like, they were married for years. And then Marvel basically decided they didn't want Spider-Man to be married anymore because it made him seem too old. But they also didn't want him to get divorced because that made him seem even older. So their grand idea solution was that they Peter and Mary Jane had to make a deal with Mephisto, who is the devil in the Marvel Universe. That Aunt May had been shot, and so Mephisto comes to them and is like, well, I will save Aunt May, and I'll restore your secret identity that had just gotten revealed in Civil War. But in return, you must give me your marriage.
How do you give someone...
there was this whole, like, pseudo-theology thing of it, is like, you know, yes, if I can defeat true love in this way, then that will be a strike against he whom I oppose, because you can't say God in a comic book for some reason, I guess. And it was just this whole, like, thing of just MJ going, it's like, yeah, okay. And, like, we have to do it to save Aunt May. I'm like, you have to make a deal with the devil to save your aunt. Okay, yeah, now it's getting really scientific.
We've gotten way off.
We're going to make deals with the devil to alter the timeline. And so, like, and it went back and, like, altered it so that they had never been married. And their big kind of retcon explanation was just that the issue where they got married, something different happened, and so they never got married. They still lived together and had a relationship, and like all of the stories still happened. They just retroactively hadn't been married for any of them.
So they just made it into.
And then for some reason, all of his extra superpowers that he got, like the organic web shooters, disappeared too.
I didn't know those were a function of his marriage. All right.
It was a confusing time for Spider-Man fans.
So web shooter. Oh, so can you get bit by a spider and get powers? Is what you were asking?
Yeah.
No. You can get bit by a spider and get an infection. That's about it.
Yeah. And if it's a radioactive spider,
maybe cancer.
You might get cancer.
Yeah. Radiation is always responsible for superpowers, and especially in early comic books because they were developed in the 50s after the atomic bomb went off, and everyone was scared about. Well, look in this. We've never experienced this. What could it do? Well, it could give you superpowers. It did not give anyone superpowers that we know of.
Yeah,
but
which is why now, like in the movies and in the in more recent comic books, it's always it's a genetically engineered or a genetically modified.
That's our new code word for magic science is genetics.
Yeah, exactly. Because like we don't know what genetics do.
A genetically
modified spider bit you, and now you are genetically modified as well.
Those crazy molecules doing whatever they want. Genetically modified. Well, that's interesting because people get all up in arms about genetically modified food. Almost everything you eat is quote unquote genetically modified. What it means is we've bred these things to be this way. We've bred bananas to be more yellow and delicious and have fewer seeds in them. We've bred all kinds of animals. I mean, we've bred chickens to be larger so we can get more McNuggets out of them. We've done all of these things to change our food around. So all of those things are forms of genetic modification. It doesn't mean someone went into a lab and literally pulled this molecule apart and put it back together again, which is what the spider bite does in the Tobey Maguire ones or the Andrew Garfield one too, I think, is that somehow there's a retrovirus in the saliva of the spider. A retrovirus will actually rewrite your DNA. Well, all viruses do that. When a virus gets into your cell, it injects a piece of its own DNA into your genetics. And so when your genes go to copy themselves, there's instructions in there to actually make viruses too, and that's how they spread. We've been researching this type of concept is, can you use this system to rewrite a person's DNA? Let's say they have a defective gene for something. They have an allergy to something that we don't want them to have, or something even worse than that. Maybe we can use a virus to rewrite their DNA that way. So we're actually working towards that. I don't know that we've been able to successfully do it to a large degree. Certainly not to the degree where you can climb up the sides of buildings and shoot spider silk out of your fingers, but... or your wrist, but it's that part of it. At least we're working on the genetic engineering at that level.
But even if we like, when we kind of get to that point of like, oh, we can start injecting animal traits into people, there's no guarantee that those web spinners are going to be in your wrists.
They could be all. Yeah, I mean, especially the first person to get. You know, who knows? If you were to ever try something like this, I don't think you want to be the first test subject because it could wind up. You know, they could be coming out of your nose.
Which yeah, be no I fun. Mean, it's an interesting thing about the early kind of Silver Age Marvel comics in particular is that a lot of the, and it was kind of the revolutionary thing for Marvel at that time, and what made them so popular, is that their heroes, you know, modified by radiation or whatever, cosmic rays.
There's always science gone wrong.
It was always science gone wrong, and then they decided to use their powers for good. But the interesting thing was always that they were much more akin to, origin-wise at least, to like the monsters of sci-fi movies and kind of the sci-fi and horror comics of the 40s and 50s.
Well, especially like the Incredible Hulk, who is green, yeah. Was made green because of Frankenstein. Like that was a deliberate choice. Say this guy is, you know, what if the Frankenstein monster was a good guy? And in fact, in the original version of the Hulk, he was gray, and they eventually made him green, which is good, because I think that's a lot more iconic anyway, that green
thing. And I mean, like, you know, you look at the parallels and what, you know, what could have happened between, like, you look at, like, Spider-Man versus, like, the Fly, mm-hmm. you know, that classic, though the Vincent Price and later the Cronenberg version with Jeff Goldblum, where it's like, oh, I'm going to splice my genes with this insect or arachnid creature, and you know, in Spider-Man, it's like, hey, I got super strength and I got this spidey sense that warns me of danger, and you know, Jeff Goldblum's like, I'm turning into a monster.
Right, I'm going to barf on donuts and slurp them back up. That's my power.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, so, you know, it's sort of two sides of the same coin.
Well, that's where the villains come in, too. I mean, like, the villains are that same thing. They're usually science gone wrong.
Yeah.
On top of that. Is there a villain
kind you want? Like, yeah.
I would say, Brandon, is there a particular villain that you think is cool or that you want to talk about?
I like all of them.
You like all villains? That's not good. That's not a good sign.
Everyone loves a good villain. Villains
that's true.
Are great. It's like it's, you get to indulge those little like private revenge fantasies. Like, I'll show them all.
That's right. They laughed at me at the Institute. yeah, I mean, where do you want to go from here, Brandon? You got an idea?
I don't know.
You got a cheat sheet of sciencey stuff.
I'm looking here, and I have no idea who Professor X is.
Oh, Professor X is the guy from the X-Men, Patrick Stewart, bald guy. Oh. The psychic guy.
Psychic powers, wheelchair. Yeah.
Sue Storm, I mean.
Oh, she's the invisible woman from the Fantastic Four. She's got two powers. She can be invisible, and she can make force fields. Somehow she got lucky and got two, where everybody else got one.
Wow.
Well, force fields are an interesting idea. That's
one. Like, yeah. It could, like...
Go ahead.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, force field. So
the interesting thing.
Sorry, Jordan. Go, Jordan, you go.
Well, the interesting thing to me about the invisibility powers in general, and Warren Ellis kind of dealt with this in his comic Planetary, is that how do you turn invisible without becoming blind? Because, like, eyes work by, you know, light entering them.
And hitting kind of, your retina. You
know, bouncing off. Whereas if you turn invisible, it functions by light passing through you. So if light is passing through your eyes without leaving any kind of impression, how do you see? So this kind of, there's always this kind of paradox that he pointed out that I thought was really interesting and had never really thought of. That how do you turn invisible? How do any of these characters who turn invisible, how are they then able to see? You know, whether it's like with Sue Storm under her own power, like, you know, like in Harry Potter where they have like the invisibility cloak or whatever. It's like, well, if it's causing light to pass through them, then how do they still see where they're going?
What was the solution in the comics? Or does he not have one?
In Planetary, his kind of Sue Storm analog, they showed her when she turned visible, she was wearing goggles, like special eyewear to like help her still see things in the electromagnetic spectrum while she had turned invisible.
I guess that would make sense if maybe you're only invisible to visible light rays, but maybe you can you're opaque in the infrared. So if you find a way to make your eyes see infrared or ultraviolet, then you'd be okay. And normal people who can only see invisible would still not be able to notice you.
Yeah.
That works. Yay, we solved one.
I have a question for kind of both of you. If you, like, what superpower could be most useful, like, for everyday life?
That's a good question. Most useful. I guess it depends on what you're job is too, right? Like, I mean, if you're a doctor versus you're in the army versus you're a mailman, like, depending on what your line of work is, you may have different needs, you know. Like, if I'm in the army, I definitely want, you know, super strength and, like, you know, so bullets don't hurt me. But if I had a job, like if I was a delivery man, I'd want to be the Flash, and I just want to be super fast, deliver all my packages, call it a day. So I don't know. Jordan, you got any ideas?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's, you know, it's what tool do you need for the task? You know, in normal everyday life, what ability do you need to, you know, get your job done? If you're, you know, working construction or something, you know, being stronger and more durable, having more stamina is good. If you're, you know, a surgeon or a doctor, you know, it's like you want steadier hands, you want precision, you want to have like good eyes.
Or the ability to wind back time a little bit after you snip.
If you want to have, you know, apply some power, you know. I think probably the most versatile power I would think of, I would say probably teleportation. Because you get some of the benefits of like super speed. Like what you were talking about with the Flash and, you know, being able to deliver your packages. Well, you could teleport anywhere and it wouldn't be moving from place to place. You would literally just be one place and then you're in another. And yeah, like you would be able to always get to your job on time, as long as you didn't oversleep. So I don't know, maybe time travel would be more versatile, because then if you did oversleep, you could just, maybe, like you were saying, wind back the time. It's like, oh, I made a mistake. Let me go back 13 seconds and
right, and correct
undo.
It.
Yeah, set right what once went wrong. Then you open up all kinds of like paradox doors and
causality problems.
Yeah, it's like, oh, this future I have wrought trying to do right. You know, it's like I went back and killed Hitler, and now dinosaurs rule the earth.
Right. Which is what would happen.
Exactly. It is exactly what would happen. They've done the math.
Yeah. Brandon, which one would you want?
I love time travel. Okay. I mean, say I did something 3 weeks ago and it affects me today. I'm like, you know what? I don't like that. I can go back and whatever.
Well, it also depends on how far back you can go, too. I mean, and assuming you de-age, right? Because, like, if you make a mistake now and you only realize it, like, 40 years from now, you don't want to wind back the clock and then be stuck in a, you know, 52-year-old body while you're 12. That's just no fun.
Yeah, it's are you physically traveling through time as yourself? Are you like sending your consciousness back to past versions of yourself? Right. So yeah, I mean, there are all these different kind of ways, and like, is it a personal ability to travel? Have you developed technology that allows you to time travel? And I think especially, I mean, you know, going back to Spider-Man for a second, really all heroes, but I think Spider-Man puts it best, is like, with great power, there must also come great responsibility. And I think time travel, since that would be like one of the greatest powers to have, it also comes with the greatest amount of responsibility. It's like, right. Oh yeah, I failed that test 3 weeks ago. Let me go back and fix it. You know, okay, did you learn anything new from doing that? Did you, you know, maybe failing that test then
would have taught you something valuable. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Learn, okay, now I need to study more. And then you deprive yourself of that lesson. Now it's like, oh, well, whatever I do, I can just always go back and fix that mistake. Well, people learn from mistakes. So they're actually kind of good to have. And, you know, going back and I'm going to undo this bad thing. Well, bad things sometimes cause good things to happen.
Right. It could be something that's bad in the short term, but then turns out to be even better in the long term than if it had never happened.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, oh, I'm going to go and stop that forest fire from raging over there and, you know, save that forest. And like, well, it turns out that, you know, by that forest fire, you know, dying, it actually allowed, you know, that's part of, like, the life cycle of the Earth. And by preventing that from happening, it creates, like, a great storm or, you know, some creature, you know, like the wildlife there, you know, winds up dying off because now the flora isn't compatible or...
And that's also, you also run into problems with chaos theory, which it deals with, you know, the math of these, you know, really far-flung consequences, which is like, that forest fire would have claimed somebody's house, but if it claims that guy's house, he goes through adversity, which makes him work hard, and ultimately he winds up developing the cure to cancer, right? That kind of far-flung, unforeseeable consequence of events. So time travel is useful in the short term. It's probably good to prevent really severe things, like say somebody gets murdered. I bet that'd be, you know, you can think a little more about would that be something you'd want to undo. But even then,
I mean, like you could, bringing it back to comic book characters. You know, if you gave Batman the ability of time travel and he could go back and prevent the death of his parents,
that would cause a lot of crime.
Become Batman,
right?
So, like, and then all the people that Batman saved.
Never get saved.
Would die or have been
mugged.
Never have been rescued. Yeah. So,
any other characters you want to talk about, or
the ones that I'm more interested in? I think we more covered.
Okay, you know. Batman. Well, I've got a few on here. I didn't know if there was any here, George. I kind of wanted. I thought Captain America was kind of an interesting one because he gets his powers through a serum. He's given an injection of what they call super soldier serum that makes him very strong and durable. And that deals with human potential, right? We talked about the genetics have a certain amount of potential in them for what you can do. So you can work out and make yourself stronger up to a point. Any ability you have, you can, in theory, maximize by working on it up to a point. The question is, you know, using things like steroids, can we push past... normal human limitations. And that's what steroids basically do, right? And it's a big controversy in sports where people say, like, hey, you're sort of cheating, right? You're boosting your stats. I think it's an interesting ethical question and a science question of how we actually go about doing this. Because there are certain things that we think are okay to do to maximize your potential. Is it cheating to use other kinds of substances that are like, oh, well, you're going to eat healthier foods and get stronger that way? Like, it's not using a quote-unquote... I mean, all foods are chemicals. Whether or not they come in a vial or whether it's a carrot. So what makes certain chemicals, quote-unquote, good chemicals, and other chemicals, bad chemicals? And I think it's the shortcut that I think that people find problematic with steroids, as well as the side effects.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, like, steroids do a lot of, you know, good things. They've been, you know, they're used in medicine all the time. It's like, okay, we need to give your system a boost so that it can fight an infection or... you know, to treat inflammatory conditions, to, you know, bring down any kind of swelling or, you know, steroids in those cases. Okay, well, that's a good thing that steroids can be used for. Just using them without any degree of consequence, just to be like, oh, I can hit a ball farther. You know, ethically, yeah, okay, you're kind of, you're cheating a little bit in that regard. But to me, I'm more concerned about, you know, like the physiological consequences of overuse of steroids. Like, you know, you use them in that sense of like making yourself better because of something that, you know, it's like, oh, I'm fighting against this condition, this infection, this disease. Then it's like, okay, I'm helping my system to repel this. Whereas, like, you know, I just don't want to, you know, work as hard, or I want the work that I do to have these gargantuan effects. There's also a drawback, you know, it's the muscle atrophy that occurs later on is much more exacerbated. You know, it only affects muscle tissue, so your tendons and ligaments are put under a great deal more strain having to deal with these kind of hypercharged muscular systems. You know, what it does to your circulatory system, to neurological functioning.
Right. How much do you want to damage yourself to get this, like, yay, I can hit a ball farther, but now the rest of my body doesn't work so good. You know, you've maxed out one thing at the expense of everything else, and it can get really unhealthy. Yeah,
the great thing with, like, Captain America and the Super Soldier Serum, a lot of people was like, oh, well, he was just taking steroids. It's like, that's the easiest analogy to draw, but, you know, kind of the reason that it's so hard to replicate and the reason that the Super Soldier Serum was so kind of unique was that it balanced out across all of his systems. It was like, okay, it's going to make you stronger, but it's also going to make you faster. It's going to make those, you know, all of your systems work better. Your neurological functions are going to be heightened. Your musculoskeletal ligaments, tendons, everything, your cells themselves are going to be able to regenerate. Because, I mean, that's how you build muscle mass, is by breaking down the cells and then having them build back up. You know, it's like when they talk about feeling the burn, you're literally feeling your cells kind of like burning off, but then growing back even stronger. And what they say with Captain America and with the Super Soldier Serum is that his cells basically kind of burn and regenerate at a much faster rate, and they're kind of constantly doing it. So it would, you know, basically be like if he was constantly working out all the time, but that just happens by him walking and breathing and like eating a sandwich. His metabolism is just heightened to that degree that all of his systems kind of get hypercharged in that function, but it's balanced out across the board. So it's not that, oh, my, you know, my muscles are supercharged, but now, you know, this over here is, you know, like my tendons and ligaments are dried out. My neurological functions are heightened, but
my digestive system's no good.
Yeah, exactly.
Just goes right through me. Actually, that brings me to one other thing about Captain America, which is the law of conservation of energy. So, and this kind of goes for any superhero, is that this, in theory, this rule applies. You can't get more energy out of a system than you put in. So, for example, for Captain America to be at this higher rate of metabolism, that means he's got to eat a lot more than regular people, right? For the Hulk to be able to be super strong and be massive, that mass has to come from somewhere. He can't just be a little scrawny guy and then get big. Otherwise, he'd be a balloon, right? He'd be big, but he wouldn't be very dense and he wouldn't be very powerful. So, he either has to be... Bruce Banner has to just be super dense and massive to begin with, or what I read in one thing was that supposedly the Hulk converts energy into mass, which is fine, although it would have to be the energy of like 2,000 suns at once to create that much mass. Actually, this probably is a good point to go to our mailbag, because we have a bunch of really cool questions in here that might take some time to answer. So, all right, let's go to our mailbag. She wrote about it.
I don't want to read all this mail.
First question is from Simon R., who wanted to know which super base makes the most scientific sense. So like, I think he means like the Batcave or Watchtower or which of these different like areas would make the most sense. Is there a particular base that you think is cool, Brandon?
Well, to me, a Batcave, because we have military bases and mountains and stuff, so I could see a Batcave being like under someone's mansion or something like that.
If you didn't know it was there. I mean, that's the Batcave's greatest advantage. One, I mean, yeah, it's a natural formation, and no one knows it's there, so it's perfectly secret, and no one's going to go looking for it. So I think that's a good one. Jordan, you got one that...
Sure. I mean, yeah, there was the JLA, the Justice League of America, had their base in a cave for a number of years. So, yeah, caves and caverns, they make a natural habitat, as long as you can deal with the environmental factors...
Yeah, I actually posted something to our Quarks and Rec Facebook page about the dangerous effects of guano. if you're around a lot of bats and they leave their feces behind, there are bacteria in there that you can get toxoplasmosis, which is nobody wants. There's all kinds of horrible diseases you can get from that. So as long as you keep the cave clean, it's okay. But
Alfred is the most important character in all of Batman lore.
That's right. He keeps Batman from getting bat-related illnesses.
Exactly.
I
feel like some of the you've got like the X Mansion at the school, kind of the Xavier's Institute for gifted youngsters, as they said back in the 60s.
That's a hiding in plain sight kind of base.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, you know, it's okay, and especially before they kind of came out as mutants and as the base of the X-Men, which happened in, I want to say 2001 during Grant Morrison's run, before that it was like, you know, it's like, oh no, this is just a school for, you know, very, very talented young people to come and study, and then they get there and it's like, and now we're going to train you to be a superhero, go put on spandex and get in the danger room.
Yeah, plus they probably get busted eventually because at some point some non-mutant person would apply to go to that school and not get in. Then they'd be like, why can't I go there? And then everyone would find out.
You get into affirmative action and their quotas, like, this many human members at your school. Okay, all right, we're
good. Yeah, lawyers ruin everything.
Avengers Mansion, I think, because there were actually, I think back, I'm trying to remember exactly... but in the 60s, like, Stan Lee actually picked a physical address in New York City to be, like, the Avengers Mansion. Like, you could go and visit where it was supposed to be, which I always thought was kind of cool because it was like, you know, like, in my head, you know, it's like I grew up in Texas, which is a mythology all unto its own. But, like, sure. You know, New York was like this... mythical place, you know. It's like that people always talked about how, oh, Marvel is so much more real because, you know, their heroes are in New York and not in Metropolis or Gotham. To me, New York was just as fictional and mythical a place as Gotham or Metropolis. And then finding out that it was like, oh no, there's actually a street address, like you could send mail to where Avengers Mansion is supposed to be. You could, like, you know, and it was always like my dream of like, oh, I'm gonna fly to New York and visit all of these landmarks that they talk about. And
it turns out now it's just like a, you know, it's just a paint barrier.
Like, you know, it's a Stuckey's or something. It's like a Shake Shack or...
Right. Shawarma restaurant. It's probably a shawarma restaurant. I think those are some pretty cool bases. The one that occurs to me as the least useful is Watchtower, which is, for a while, the Justice League had a space station that they stayed on, which is fine, except the problem is anytime there's crime, you don't have to get from a space station down to the Earth to solve a problem, which is fine if you're Superman or the Green Lantern, but Batman, for to get up into orbit and down again, that's a little harder for him or some of the others. So,
yeah, they had a teleporter on board, kind of Star Trek style.
Okay. Problem solved.
Which is actually technology where they think we're on the cusp of developing.
Well, we were able to teleport
like light
particles.
Like
essentially, yeah. The signature of a photon kind of thing, and it takes an enormous amount of energy. And then the other problem for teleportation is, even if you were to take apart all of your molecules, somehow beam them somewhere and reassemble them, would you live through it? Which, I mean, I could cut you in half and sew you back together. All your molecules would be there, but I think you wouldn't survive it, right, Brandon?
I don't think so.
Let's try it, shall we?
Yeah, okay.
Well, it was interesting. I was reading... was reading a theory about, and I think it was like, it was some, might have been like Star Trek forum or something, but somebody was talking about kind of the metaphysics of teleportation, that like, if your molecules got ripped apart and then reassembled somewhere else, would that still be you, or did you just get killed and a new version of you got reassembled? And like, kind of the information that got beamed into it, you still think it's you, but you know, it would be like the essential thing of like, if you got cloned and all of your memories got sent into the clone, is that still you? Or you know, so I thought those were interesting questions to ask, sort of the, you know, like, what happens to the soul during teleportation? And, you know, those kind of, those questions you can't really answer because they're kind of outside of that scientific realm, but things that actually, you know, it's like, okay, if there is, you know, if we do consider something to be essentially us, you know, if there is a self, if there is a soul, if there is, you know, something beyond just our body and, you know, the firing of our neurons, and that gets transmitted, is that still us? Is that essentially us, or did we just create a new version of ourselves?
That's an impossible question to answer, but here's one.
Exactly. But, you know, just a head scratcher to think on.
Yeah. Here's another question from our mailbag. Ryan H. wants to know, are there any superpowers you think humans could actually evolve? Brandon, you got any thoughts on that one? Like, something that if our species went in a particular direction, could we evolve a quote-unquote superpower over time?
I don't think so.
I guess it depends on what you define as a, quote, superpower, because for us, fish have the superpower because they can breathe underwater. Like, it's just a power that we don't have. Now, certain things like psychic blasts and flight, like we talked about, those can't happen.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, we have superpowers compared to fish. I mean, our intelligence. We breathe air, smarter than most things here, so...
Right, I think so. The one that comes to my mind that humans can act, I think could eventually evolve some kind of, if, again, this would require selective pressure for this trait and countless generations for it to actually develop, because it would take millions of years in this direction. But I think Daredevil's echolocation. Like, that's a power that some animals on Earth actually have. Dolphins, bats, they have echolocation. They can use sound to, quote-unquote, see where things are. And that's what Daredevil does. He's blind, but he uses sound to see. And there are even a few blind people who do have primitive versions of that, that they are able to use sound to some degree to figure out where they are. So I think that's the most realistic one for people to be able to develop. Not saying they will do this. There still needs to be selective pressure, meaning that trait has to help you survive just a little bit better than everybody else. And the problem with it is, if you're blind, you're probably at more of a disadvantage to reproduction. So it's, you get the echolocation, it's one step forward, but the blindness is like three steps back.
Yeah, so it would have to be like a circumstance where like the entire species existed under conditions where they were blinded. So that's just a constant across the board.
Right, it's just like, dark.
Yeah. Either we get physically blinded in some way, or our environment becomes darker, more limited in that way, and then certain people develop that trait. I think definitely, you know, kind of along those lines of a heightened physical traits, I don't think we could ever necessarily get up to, like, Hulk or Superman levels of strength. But
our skeleton, that's material science. Like, our skeletons and our muscles just aren't made of stuff that can handle that. No matter how much bone you have or how much muscle you have, there's still, it's still bone and muscle.
Yeah.
So. But if we, like, if there were conditions where, like, you had to be stronger or you had to be faster. We were talking about, you know, cheetahs and I think most jungle cats, most cats in kind of the jaguar family are incredibly fast, and they've developed that speed over generations. I mean, if we were under conditions where that was a necessity, sure, probably not the Flash level. I don't think we're going to be tapping into the Speed Force anytime soon, but certainly where, I mean, you know, you look at Olympic runners, or, you know, just really any Olympic athlete who's developed these kind of abilities, it's like they tend to be more physiologically prone to those abilities, to developing, like, being stronger, being faster. There are certain elements that, like, okay, you know, your muscles and your bones are formed in such a way where you are more naturally tended towards developing these skills and these traits.
Right. Like, a good example I can think of is someone like Michael Phelps, the swimmer. Like, if you look at him, his body just looks like a torpedo. Now, he is lucky that not only does he happen to have this physique that is, you know, good for swimming, but he happened to take up swimming as an interest. Like, he could have decided, hey, I want to play the violin, and we never would have known. But because we had this confluence of a guy who is physically, like, has all the genetic advantages for swimming and the desire to swim, has pushed his body beyond the point where you think, like, a normal person would be good at swimming, he can go that much faster and that much better because he has that genetic roll of the dice.
Yeah, I mean, you even talk to people who work in that, and then it's like, you know, there is the turn. It's like, oh, you have a swimmer's build, because there is a specific way that a body is shaped that is advantageous to swimming. I got told that a lot when I was in high school. It's like, oh, you got a good swimmer's build. And Michael Phelps was probably told much the same, that he decided to go into swimming and training every day.
And you did improv.
And I decided to do improv in theater and read comic books and eat tacos.
Right.
You know, and, I mean, we both made life choices, and I feel like this is no more valid than mine.
Yeah. All right, next question. Cameron J. wants to know, what super technology is the most feasible? Like the Batmobile or the Iron Man suit, something like that. So instead of a superpower that could evolve, a piece of super machinery.
Sure.
Brandon, you got one that you think is cool?
Well, maybe, what's his, Captain America's, like,
The shield?
Yeah, maybe something like lead can't really break very easy. Like, say you bring a thing of lead around. I mean, something.
That's actually a pretty good one. I didn't think of the shield. The shield is in the comics is made out of a fictional substance called vibranium. But there are certainly really strong materials. You could build people have been using shields for thousands of years, just made out of
metal
or wood or things like that. That's another thing we had mentioned before, science called materials science. There's another science called metallurgy, and that's the study of the different properties of metals and going, all right, if we take this much lead and this much iron and this much platinum or other metals and we mix them together in a certain way or in certain ratios, we can get different properties out of those materials. So I think that's actually a feasible one. You could make a very powerful shield. I don't think you could make it necessarily come back to you when you throw it.
No.
Like the great advantage with Cap Shield, and in the comics, I think it's actually, and they can't do this because of the rights issues in the movies, but Cap Shield, is that like what you're talking about with alloys? Is actually an alloy of vibranium and adamantium, which is the metal that's bonded to Wolverine's bones, but which is, you know, very dense and heavy. And so I feel like there's, you could make like a really strong shield that, you know, can like repel and, you know, maybe, but the great thing with Cap's shield is that it has that kind of thing, but the vibranium makes it very lightweight. Like you said, it also makes it a good, like, projectile weapon. He can throw it out and, you know, hit people with it like a discus. And then, you know, he works out the trajectory in his head where it'll always come back to him. And so it's, I think you could make, like, a really heavy and impenetrable shield, but it's making one that's, like, lightweight enough to carry around. Maybe not that you can throw and then have come back to you, but that's not going to also be, like, cumbersome to have to be. It's like, oh no, I gotta lug around this, you know, 500-pound shield right everywhere. Like, you know, again, it's that matter of balance. You want to have, like, you want to develop it where it's a lightweight enough material that you can carry it around.
And but it's sturdy enough to take a bullet, yeah.
Exactly. And they've certainly developed different, I mean, we were talking about Kevlar before, as far as, like, ceramic weaves, but they've done a lot of work with, like, not just with metals, but with ceramics, of developing them in such a way where they are that super dense material that can, you know, kind of take a lot of damage or a lot of bullets, but are, because they're ceramic instead of metal, are much lighter weight. So, yeah, I think that's a good example.
Okay. That's I think it's a good answer, too. Let me move on to the next question. We got three more to get through. And Danielle C. wants to know, Magneto is always put in a non-metal prison. Could we build something he couldn't escape from? So, Brandon, you know who Magneto is, right? The bad guy from the X-Men movies. He's can move metal around. And in various movies, I think they stick him in some kind of a plastic prison, and he manages to escape time and again.
Lead?
Well, no, lead, well, different metals have different responses to magnetism. I don't think lead is particularly magnetic, so that's one. But I think it would be better to make something that had no metal in it.
Like wood?
Yeah, wood's good. I mean, the problem is you need, I guess you don't have to use nails to put together. You can use, like, wooden dowels and glue.
Glue?
Yeah. Then you can probably, that might be easy to get off just because it's flimsy. I mean, the problem is, I think, you need to know what the extent of his powers are, right? Because there's trace amounts of metal all over the place, or there's just, like, how far away can he summon metal from? Like, I don't know if that's really made clear. Like, in the last X-Men movie, he lifted up an entire stadium. And in one of the movies, in the second X-Men movie, he pulls the iron out of somebody's blood to be able to escape. So, it's not clear exactly.
Oh, and in that one too, he was that guard got injected with
extra iron,
excess amounts of iron. It wasn't like the natural iron in his blood being pulled out. It was
injected him. But even if he can take out a little blood from or iron from somebody's blood, like he can siphon off a little every time that guard comes back to bring him lunch or whatever. He can just pull a little bit of iron, stick it in the corner of the room, and like just keep doing that. Until he gets what he needs. Or, like I said, if depending on the range of his powers, like, yeah, you can build this plastic prison on an oil rig in the middle of the ocean, but if he can pull trace amounts of metal out of, that are just in the atmosphere, or, like, pull a rock up from the bottom of the ocean, like, it's hard to, I guess the limits of the prison are kind of the limits of the writer's imagination.
Yeah, and it's kind of depends on the interesting thing, in the movie, it's presented as such a way where it's like, okay, his power of magnetism lets him control metal, which is how he started out, but they kind of expanded it over the years to, it's like, well, if he's the master of magnetism, like, magnetism is one of the fundamental forces of the universe.
Right.
So it's like, what are the actual limits of his powers? It's in one story, they were going to have it, or he threatened to, never actually did, they almost did it in the story, and then the editors kind of chickened out, but reverse the polarity of the Earth itself and basically switch the poles around and, like, change our orbit and, which would have
an effect. Massive. Yeah.
Does he even need metal around at that point? Because, like, electromagnetism in particular, it's like, if he focused enough and, you wanted to get sciencey-winesy enough with it, he could just affect gravity.
Right.
He could just siphon off of electrons in the air to affect his powers. It's not just, we get the classic example all the time of, like, well, you've got this little bar magnet, and then if you rub it together, and then, it attracts a nail, and that's how we teach kids about magnetism. But the actual extent of magnetism goes way beyond just, I can attract metal together.
Right. That's true.
So, it, like you said, it depends on what the writer wants the extent of his power to be. They limited him in the movie to make him a little more realistic. In the comics, at times, he's been close to, like, the powers of a god at times. So.
Yeah. Cool. Next question. This is from Brendan B. He wants to know, this is a cliche comic book geek question, but scientifically speaking, so science power time, who would win in a fight, Superman or the Hulk?
Superman.
I gotta go Superman as well. My feeling is he can pick up the Hulk and just throw him into the sun.
Yeah.
At which point, fight is over. But Hulk's not gonna go quietly, so.
No, it's, and you have to,
Well, it also depends on strength. So strength, there's lots of different kinds of strength, too. So there's literal, like, punching strength. That's gonna be force equals mass times acceleration, right? If I accelerate my fist this fast, and my fist has this much mass, I can tell how much force it's going to generate. That's just one of Isaac Newton's basic laws. So if we know how hard the Hulk can punch, we can know how massive he is versus how fast he is, all of those things combined. Then there's tensile strength, which is like how hard, could Superman rip the Hulk's arm off? Like how, like for example, this piece of paper in front of me, I can rip it in half really easily, but it's harder to, say, punch through it. because of the way the polymers and this in the pulp of the paper align, it has different types of strength properties depending on what you do to it. So you have to know a lot of these factors for both characters to be able to figure that out, who wins.
I would say Superman. I wouldn't necessarily go with the example of, like, he would throw the Hulk into the sun. I mean, I would say Superman has a greater range of powers. Like, Hulk is strong, mm-hmm. and he's invulnerable, but Superman is strong and invulnerable, but also fast, and heat vision, and cold breath, and
everything else.
And even, like, I really like the kind of the Grant Morrison take that, like, that his mind works in much greater and more imaginative ways than necessarily. Whereas, like, Hulk is like a rage monster. He has no focus. He has no control. He's just lashing out. Superman is able to be much more precise,
right,
and apply his powers. So I feel like he would be able to find a solution. It wouldn't just be as like, oh, Hulk, throw him into the sun. It's like, well, okay, could Superman do that? Maybe. Would he?
No.
Probably not, because he's Superman. He would be as like, you know, all right, well, I'm going to toss you this quarter of a mile to this construction site I noticed back there, land you in this pile of wet cement, and then I'm going to come and superheat it with my heat vision, and then wrap these steel girders around you until you calm down and turn into Banner, and then we can come to a greater solution.
Right.
Or just like, oh, here's a nerve point I can hit on you. Boom. Batman taught me jiu-jitsu, so I'm going to do a super-powered chop to your deltoid and, like, numb your arm and just keep doing nerve blocks until you can't move anymore.
Right. So there you have it. Probably Superman. And then the last question... this is from Alexandra S. She wants to know, if people with superpowers actually showed up, how do you think the scientific community would react?
By scientific community, they mean just, like, people.
Well, no, I think they mean scientists specifically. Like, how would science treat the arrival of people with superpowered abilities, whether they were natural
terrible.
Or not? You think terrible?
I mean, like, not like we actually know. We see the movies where they're just terrible to, like, aliens, and I think they'd be, like, you know, they take them, and all they do is cut it open and... look at them.
See, I have a more optimistic approach. I think most scientists view the world as kind of with a big curious eye, and I think they would want to be respectful to the superpowered individual, so I don't think they'd want to, like, just throw them in a glass prison or whatever and then start lasering into them. I think they'd want to, their curiosity would lead them to think, we can learn more by working with this person rather than, you know, holding them against their will. I mean, yeah, we do kind of cut open lab animals and, you know, those kind of things happen, but this would be a sentient, this would be a person. This wouldn't be, some sort of lower mammal or a reptile to just cut in half. This would probably be a person. So my vote would be that the scientific community would be welcoming and curious and excited to learn.
Yeah, I think, you know, the community as a whole, you might get, like, one or two bad eggs or, you know, some unethical ones, or it's like, yes, let me vivisect him and see how his organs work. But on the whole, I don't see, like, Neil deGrasse Tyson tying up anybody, like, in his secret lair and performing strange experiments on him. I think
I hope Neil deGrasse Tyson has a secret lair, though. He has to have
one. I mean, I hope he has a secret lair. I'm pretty sure he does. Mm. I just don't think that he's going to tie up anybody in it.
Probably more of a wine cellar. In a secret
yeah,
way.
Exactly.
Yeah. We better
mention first editions of books.
Yeah, we probably have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you so much for coming on, Jordan. Is there anything you want to plug while you're here?
Let's see. If you're in the Austin, Texas area, I've got a couple of shows at the Hideout Theater and the Institution Theater. Scene of the Crime and Buzz Band are coming up. And yeah, look for me. My improv troupe is Indigo Shift. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/shiftindigo. And we're always doing plays and end of the world cabaret style improv. Come see us sometime.
Cool. If you like the show and you want to get involved with us, you can go to facebook.com/quarksandrec, or you can go to Twitter and tweet at us at quarksandrec, or just go to our website, which is quarksandrec.com. All our previous shows are posted up there, and you can listen to them and enjoy, and ask us questions for our next one. And in fact, our next topic is going to be the science of music, which is going to be pretty cool.
Ooh, that's awesome.
It'll be fun. And until then, I'm Doug.
I'm Brandon.
And thank you so much. Thanks for coming on, Jordan.
Thank you. Excelsior.
Excelsior.